Oak Station number 12204, Reel 2.
Mr. Image, Reel 2.
Yeah. Then we had Lance Corporal Waters, Corporal Waters, Sergeant Waters, and then what was I calling? Chief Waters. There were two grades of Chief Order. Chief Order 2, Chief Order 1. And most of the water staff were disciplined staff. They were just ordinary, basically uneducated African staff. Working alongside them, you had clerical staff, water clerks and so forth, with the same rankings, who were literate, that is, they could read and write in English. And they used to do the office work with us. So at Creature I had Gilbert, who was a chief water clerk, a very bright chap, and Samuel Amore Zabuki, who was a water clerk. And between them they'd been running the paperwork. And I sat in with them and learned what was going on by supervising it. And it was comparatively easy. Just a question of reading the prison regulations until I was familiar with them, and seeing what I was supposed to do and what I wasn't supposed to do. I was entirely on my own at first, in that I had no communication with any other prison's establishment. The next senior officer was at Kisumu, which was 60-something miles away from us over dirt roads, very poor condition quite frequently. And I had no transport, so no means of getting over there. The first time I met him, I borrowed a car to go across to Kisumu and introduce myself to him. And then eventually I did get a telephone installed. I requested it and they did install a telephone, so then I was able to communicate with Nairobi occasionally by telephone. Otherwise that was it. We were entirely on our own. Phoned in at the deep end, as it were.
How many inmates were there in the prison?
Well, it was built for 80, but when I took it over it had 300 in it.
How many of them were to do with Mamo?
Hardly any. We had one Kikuyu who had been picked up there on suspected Mamo activity. I can't remember what he was actually convicted of, because it was a convict prison. But otherwise, they were all local people. Kipsigis was the main local tribe. The odd Kisi were around and about. A couple of Maasai, but they were very rare because it was a bit far away from Maasai land. So they were mainly local, the odd Nandi, but mainly Kipsigis prisoners.
What was this Mau Mau chap? Had he been convicted, or was he?
Oh yes, it was a convict. Yeah, not a detainee.
What had he been convicted of?
I can't remember what his actual offence was. So it couldn't have been anything very outstanding. I remember the man. In fact, I got a photograph of him up there in the book. That it was. When I first got there, the little box brownie, and I was busily taking photographs of all sorts of things, and I took one of him.
What was he like?
Oh, quite reasonable, no trouble at all.
Was he Kikuyu?
Yes, he was Kikuyu. Mm. They were pretty bright, basically. The Kikuyu were one of the brighter tribes. But none of them were really any great trouble. Didn't have any great bother with them. The next posting I did, I was sent off to Magaita Island in Lake Victoria.
Which island?
Magaita, M-A-G-E-T-A. It was a small pear-shaped island, about 2.5 miles across at its widest point, and 3-4 miles long, I suppose. Yes, I can't remember the exact length, but something like that. And it was about 5 miles offshore in Lake Victoria. And there they had, when I first took it over, Mau Mau detainees. They were virtually all men who had been sentenced to death under the emergency regulations and then had their sentences commuted to life imprisonment, which meant life. They were there till they died, sort of thing, in those days. This was all changed later when they announced the amnesties and things, and they did. We were all eventually released, but at that time, life meant life. And we had some very hard characters there. We had the men who'd murdered Chief Hinga. He was a loyalist chief who'd been very much on the side of the government and was noted, and they got hold of him one day on the Athi Plains and killed him by cutting the flesh off his chest and face until he died, and stripped him right down to the white of his skull and his ribs. And then, of course, by that time he was dead. There were one or two murders about then. They'd murdered Chief Waruhiu as well, shot him in his car. They were all up there, but they weren't too bad actually. They had their own little ways in the camps. They had their own command structure, which was supposed to be secret from us. We weren't supposed to know that. But I found the camp documentation one day when I was prowling around. They had a sort of homemade table thing in the middle of one of the compounds with racks where they used to dry dishes on and put mugs on and things like that for sort of innocuous purpose. And I was prowling about it one day and found it had a secret shelf underneath and tucked away, and there were all the camp records that they were keeping. And they had their own little discipline set up. If any man broke their regulations, one of which was cooperating with the European officers, which in fact they all did, but this was one of the, if anybody went too far out of line according to their ways, he would be fined so many goats to be paid after freedom when the Mau Mau had won the battle and they all went home. He would then pay up certain whatever number of goats he'd been fined, because goats was their currency. I don't know what effect that had on it, but I found all their records.
What did you do with the records?
Oh, I handed them in, I think. I must have sent them down the line to my superiors who were in Kisumu.
Could you read
to them? Show them what was going on. Yes, a lot of them were in English, actually. They used to like to write English to demonstrate their superiority over the others and show their education.
What type of things did the records say?
Oh, just that so-and-so, say Thuo, son of Mwangi, or some Kikuyu names like that, had committed this or that crime, cooperated with a European officer or done something of that nature, and was fined 3 goats to be paid on release.
And which group of detainees were keeping these records?
Well, they were all Kikuyu there. Well, nearly all Kikuyu. We had the odd Meru and Embu, but bulk of them were Kikuyu.
But was it this gang who'd murdered that?
Oh, no, they were just in the general run of prisoners there. we used to... It was very much like a wartime prisoner of war camp in many ways. We had 4 compounds with 3 or 4 huts in each compound, and they were all surrounded by a double barbed wire fencing with dennet wire, that is coiled barbed wire, in between the double fencing and at the top to stop any efforts to climb out. And we had pillboxes at each corner, and at the main gate we had a tower, and at some of the other intervals along the wire in between the pillboxes, and we would have Bren guns up in those towers. And then the armory, I've got a photograph of that in the book if you want to see that later, was built like something out of Beaujolais. It was a definite fort with battlements on the top and a tower, battlemented tower in one corner, and rifle slits at ground level. So in the event that the prisoners got out and overran us, we could retire into the armory and hole up there while we radioed for help.
Did you have any escapes?
Yeah, we had one major escape while I was there. One of the warder staff was... what was he? He wasn't a Kikuyu, but he was one of the related tribes, Meru or Embu or one of those, I think, and he was very much Mau Mau orientated, as we found out afterwards. And he very cleverly took out a party of 8 prisoners just before the changing of the guard. He was a corporal. His name was Mazay Muli, I remember him. Mazay being Swahili word for elder. Mazay Muli. And he led them out, and then they secreted, hid themselves in the bush, and he was taking them on the excuse they were going for water. And he didn't tell the incoming corporal of the guard that there were any outs, so the corporal of the guard thought the camp was there. And it wasn't until the evening lock-up, when they were all counted, that we realised that these nine men were missing. And they had arranged with the fishermen, the Luo fishermen from the mainland, to pick them up in a large canoe to take them over to the mainland. And he was expecting one or two, I think, and when he saw nine, he got a bit frightened and tried to run for it, and they chopped him up. I've got photographs of his body upstairs, and they were all slashed apart. And they got across to the mainland. In fact, they were all right on the mainland before we realised they were missing. But we didn't know that at the time. Sort of turned out the guard, locked everybody up, searched, split up into search parties, searched the island from one end to the other. Of course, we didn't find anything. But they were all accounted for. One was speared by a tribal policeman on the mainland, one was shot, and the other seven were hanged for the murder of this Luo fisherman. So it was a clean sweep, accounted for the lot. I gave some very crucial evidence at their murder trial. So,
were there ever any riots? Or
not when I... No, not when I was there. There was no, we had none at all. No, no trials. I got on very well with them. I was never harsh, like some people were with them. Firm discipline, but fair. So we never had any trouble at all there. It could easily have happened, because we'd had an Australian officer there. He was a bit of a fool. I mean, shame to speak ill of the dead. He was drowned in a boat accident. So, and that was his own stupid fault. He was a bit of a drinker. And he'd ordered the boat to go out in high water, high winds, because there was a very large inland lake, Lake Victoria, and the waves get very rough in the storms. And the boatman had said to him it wasn't safe, and he insisted that they take him ashore. And as soon as it got outside the breakwater, the waves just turned it over, and down it went. Fairly shallow water. In fact, one woman was rescued standing on the side of it as it was sunk on the bottom. She was stood there up to about the waist, but he died, although it was discovered in the autopsy that he hadn't drowned. He died. He'd had a heart attack when the boat went over, and he was already dead when he went into the water. But that shows you the sort of fellow he was. And sometime or other, he got from the police, I think, when they were closing down the police station, he got from some friend of his about 300 pangas, you know, sort of machete-like weapon, and brought them on the island to be used for work, but hadn't entered them into the camp books. So there were all these uncounted pangas hidden all around the island. So at any time, the work parties, if they'd felt that way, could have probably found these pangas, because they must have known where they were, where they were secured in little caches, I suppose. But they never did. We never did have any trouble when I was there. But as I was leaving, so they brought in a lot of convicts. They shifted the detainees and put in convicts. They were a very nasty crowd of convicts, and after I left, there were quite severe riots on Magator Island. One or two officers suffered fractured skulls and things like that. I don't think anyone was actually killed. They were quite serious injuries.
You mean the convicts were worse than the...
Yes, they were worse than the detainees. So, in fact, the same ones from Magator, afterwards came down to Embakasi, where I was. At that time, we were building Nairobi Airport. They called it the airport that was built in Posho and Beans. That's when we laid down the main runway. In the foundation, we buried an issued tin plate with a day's ration of Posho and Beans on it. A symbolic gesture, because that was the convicts' diets, you see. Or the prisoners' diets. And we had about 8,000 men there, all busily working on the foundations and laying out of Embakasi Airport.
Why should you not have been harsh when other people were?
Just my nature, I suppose.
Not because you hadn't lived through the Mau Mau?
Oh, no. No, no. It's just my nature.
What dates were you at Magator Island?
It would have been about October 1955 I went there, I think. Not quite sure when I came away. It would have been after about 6 months, I think. I contracted Bill Hartsell from swimming in the lake while I was there. And I went to hospital in Kitsuma, and shortly after that I was posted away from from Gator Island, went down to Embakasi, and worked there not very long, a few months only, and then I was posted away from there. I'm not sure where I went from Embakasi. I think I was down at Mara River for a while, which was a very remote camp full of Mau Mau. They were detainees, Mau Mau detainees, right out in game country, wild animal country, where people go on hunting safaris and so forth. In fact, we never had a successful escape from there. The odd ones that broke out were all killed by animals before they could get back to civilization, as it were, or back to their tribal areas. And while I was there, we started emptying that out. They start a policy of putting people in camps in their own home areas as the next step towards eventual release, and using local people to debrief them, in effect. They had what were they called now? My wife could probably help out my memory here. We had civilian staff sort of doing resettlement, although I don't think that's what they were. Rehabilitation, that's what they called, rehabilitation staff, yeah. Rehab officers, we used to call them. And they would question and try and debrief all these prisoners, because it was considered important that they all confessed everything they'd done fully before they were released, to break down their allegiance to Mau Mau, having taken the Mau Mau oaths, which were very binding. Only by rejecting all that and spilling it and making a clean breast of everything did it break the power of the oath, and they could then go out and start leading a normal life again. And we were emptying the camp, bringing them up by road, about 11 hours it used to take, 55 minutes by air, 11 hours by road to get from the camps up to Nairobi. And I'd started courting the wife by then. I was in the first stages of courting her. So I used to get up to see her for an hour and then sort of have to go back.
What was the name of this camp?
Mara River.
How do you spell it?
M-A-R-A. Mara River. Mara River runs through the game country. If ever you see a game film about the tracks of the wildebeest, they always cross the Mara River. In hundreds and thousands of them used to go across there. So we were right on the banks of the Mara River.
Which year was this when they were doing the rehabilitation?
Well, they were doing it right through until the end of the emergency, about, what would that be, 62, 63.
But when do you think you were at Mara River?
That must have been a bit before that. Been about 1956 or so when it actually ended, that one. Because I was at Nyeri when Dayton Kamathi was captured. So well, it would have been just after I met the wife. She would remember better than I would, because she's got a better head for that sort of thing. In the night, about 1957.
What did you think to
them? Or maybe before that even. 56 it could have been.
What do you think to the work that these rehabilitation officers were carrying out?
Well, I didn't really know an awful lot about it. They used to operate in their own world. And we just used to run the camp, looking after the discipline and security of the camp sort of thing, keeping the people in. And they used to do their own work. They had an African staff of Kikuyus who'd question these people and try and break them down and get their stories out of them. Some of them wouldn't do, even at the end they were pretty hard. But there were only a small handful, the majority of them were only too pleased to confess what they'd done and get back again. In fact, if I go up and find that letter from General Rusher, he says in there how anxious he is to cooperate and make a keen breast of everything. And a lot of them were by that time. I mean, they knew more or less it was over. And once Dayton Kimathi was captured, I was at Karatina Works Camp. I was commandant there at that time, which was in the foothills of Mount Kenya, just about 80 miles down the road from Nyeri, when Dayton Kimathi was captured. And he'd come from that area, and they had the leaflets printed, of which I've got one still, in English and Kikuyu. The one I've got in Kikuyu, it has a picture of Dayton Kimathi in bed because he'd been wounded, and he's laying in the prison hospital bed with his left hand out of bed on the sheet because he was missing that finger. And that's everyone would know that it was Dayton Kimathi. He's lying there like that. And I remember seeing them gather around Government Land Rover, which had one of these posts on the windscreen, pointing at this thing. Oh, look at the finger, that's definitely Dayton Kimathi.
That was the finger next to the little finger.
Yes, I think it's that finger. You'd be able to look on the poster actually and confirm which one it is.
On the left hand.
Yeah.
What do you personally remember about his capture?
Well, I was there in that area at the time when he was captured. So he was in Nyeri prison, but I didn't actually see him. He was in the prison. I visited the prison while he was there, but he was in the hospital wing. I didn't have any reason to go and look at him particularly. And of course he was subsequently taken down to Nairobi for his trial and was hanged afterwards in Nairobi prison.
You were commandant of which camp at the time?
Karatina. Karatina, Karatina Works Camp. It was a small town, Karatina, what we called a boma in Swahili, consisting broadly of one street with a few shops in and people and villages round and about, huts, houses, a few houses for the Europeans, very small, about 14 Europeans there, most of whom were young men in district officers, Kikuyu Guard, they were called, the OKG, they were called up for the emergency and served as district officers out in reserves, keeping an idea of what was going on. And they were all sort of disbanded when things were over.
What impression did you get of the Kikuyu tribe, apart from, as you've said, their ability?
Oh, quite reasonable. We didn't have any great bother with them by that time. We all had Kikuyu houseboys. I had one, mine was called Morris. I took him over from the fellow before me at Karatina, the fellow I was relieving, going off on leave. I inherited Morris from him, and he was very good. He stayed with me for years, even after we were married. He was very good, a good cook, good houseboy, very attached to me. In fact, he resented my wife when we first got married. She used to complain as she would bake a cake, he resented this because that was his job, and he would go and open the oven door to try and make it go flat and spoil it but he wasn't looking.
So he felt as though he was doing you
something. Yes, in a way he did, really. It was his job to look after me. He was very much my boy. Most people had this sort of relationship with their house staff, their own personal house boys, kept them for years and years, worked together, and you would pay them when you went off on home leave to England. They'd always be waiting when you got back.
From having been in charge of Mau Mau people in the camps, what kind of Kikuyu did you get the impression had supported Mau Mau?
It was pretty mixed. There was a lot around the central province, Kiambu district, Nyeri. A lot of them around there did, but there were also quite a number that were loyalists. One fellow, what's his name? It'll come to me when you've gone. He was a typical old African chief, had vast numbers of children. His village was on a ridge in Kikuyu land, and he ran up the Union Jack over his village when the trouble broke out and held out staunchly, being pro-government all the way through. In fact, he formed a home guard unit out of his own sons. Every one of them was his son. Every man, he had that many children. What is his name? No, it was a very old man. It's one of those things that will come to me tomorrow after you've gone. He was. But there were instances like that, you see, when people were very firmly pro-government. And he had a strongly entrenched village on top of this ridge, and an absolutely loyal Home Guard unit, because they were all his sons. So he survived very well right through the worst of it. They weren't too bad, really. I had one go at the wife and I. I had a camp, one of my last camps, out about 20 miles outside Nairobi. And the wife and I had been out one night in a little Volkswagen Beetle we had at that time. And when we came back, they built a barrier of stones across the road up to the camp to try and get us to stop. But unfortunately, fortunately for us, I suppose, they just built it across the road, and we were able to drive round it on the grass verge and get up the camp to the guard, where I promptly saw the wife into the house, and then turned out the guard and went back down the road to look. But if there was anybody in ambush, they'd gone by the time we got back down there.
Did you have any other incidents of apprehension?
Well, sometimes, see, the alarm would go in the night, there'd be odd sort of incidents, attempts at breakout or this, that and the other. We just wouldn't know, we'd hear the alarm go off. Quite frequently, be a false alarm. I just used to run out, buckling on my gun belt with the wife saying, be careful, and go and see what had happened and sort it out. And I never had anything really dreadfully serious at my camps, fortunately.
How apprehensive, if at all, were you in Kenya for your own safety?
Not a lot, I don't think, really. On the Gator Island, we used to take precautions because, as I say, there were all those weapons there, and they had 1,500 prisoners there. And what did they have? About 300 border staff to look after them, about four officers. So there, we used to have barbed wire around our quarters and the officers' quarters, and I would have a loaded revolver on the bedside table and a Sten gun with a magazine in on the floor beside the bed, just in case. And when he went to have a bath, he'd put a revolver in the soap dish so you wouldn't be caught, like poor old Bill Bokes. He was an ex-RAF chap, Wing Commander Bill Bokes, and they caught him in his bath and chopped him up. So thereafter, it was just to put a gun in the soap dish just in case that sort of thing happened. But,
whilst you were in Kenya doing that job, what did you learn about Mau Mau, would you say?
Oh, I had quite a lot of stuff. I gave the Imperial War Museum a whole lot of the copy of the Mau Mau Oathing and all that sort of thing.
What did you learn from your own first-hand experience about its causes and...
Basically the causes, it was seen by the Kikuyu as a sort of freedom struggle. They were preached that if they could get rid of the Europeans, they'd all be rich like Europeans were. The only reason they were poor was that Europeans had all the jobs and were earning all the money. And if they could only throw them out, they'd become rich. And so it was a nationalist thing, really, with the Kikuyu. But it was very limited. People talk about the Mau Mau and Kenya, but it was only in the Kikuyu district in the centre that anything really happened. People at either end, like Kisumu, up near the Uganda border,